Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect introduces Laurel Rothman, the Director of Social Reform for Family Service Toronto and the National Director of Campaign 2000. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Laurel, as we discussed, I found your name and your paper in the Star Wednesday, August 4th, when you had prepared a paper for a meeting prior to the Premier's meeting last week on Thursday the 5th. And the Star wrote about it on August the 4th. You were asking the premiers to consider poverty. Is that correct?
Yes.
And they did meet on the 5th, yes?
The premiers met, actually the 4th, the premiers met the 5th and the 6th, yes.
Okay. Did they get a photo off with a polar bear?
I don't know. I wasn't in Churchill with them. We held our round table on August 4th in Winnipeg with about 40 partners of our partner organizations representing low-income people, Aboriginal peoples, housing providers, healthcare providers, childcare providers, faith communities. We were pleased to have the president of the Manitoba Chambers of Commerce with us.
Oh, good.
As well as we invited, I'm leaving somebody out, women's groups, our partner, the YWCA of Canada.
Yeah.
Ethno-racial groups, the Islamic Social Service Organization of Canada, and many others.
Yeah.
And Canadian Council, Campaign 2000 held this roundtable in conjunction with, in partnership with the Social Planning Council of Winnipeg.
Okay.
And further collaborated with the Council of Canadians with Disabilities.
Okay.
And the Canadian Council on Social Development.
All right. Sounds like more groups than came under consideration at the Premier's meeting.
Well, hard to know. I would say that we were about 40 people in the room.
Right.
And at least 15 online via conference call and webinar screen, a computer screen, from across the country, just about every province.
Okay.
Oh, Labor, that's who I forgot. Of course, our Labor partners.
All right.
And we reviewed this statement. We basically reviewed it. We ratified it and added some commentary that we will append to it, which basically outlines what we think are the very broad strokes of what the federal government needs to do and the provincial government and territorial governments need to do to have a serious plan to eradicate poverty in Canada.
Yeah, that's an ambitious goal. Do you think it resonates with politicians?
Well, I think to be fair, I forgot to say, in addition to all of those I mentioned, we also invited each of the federal parties to send someone, and three out of the four parties did.
Okay. So
the official opposition, the Liberals, the NDP, the Bloc Québécois came to Winnipeg. We were
really
very pleased. And Senator Art Eggleton, who had just has just finished last December a big report on from his Senate committee called In from the Margins about poverty and homelessness.
Okay.
So because I think our message is it's really, poverty eradication is all of our issues. We need civil society. We need the business community. We need all of our partners. But we cannot do it without strong government leadership. We've had leadership from 6 provinces that have established poverty reduction strategies of varying types. 1 territory is in process. And the federal government, there's been some activity at the federal level, but we need to have a more focused approach at the federal level. We were very discouraged when the federal government's at the federal government's official response to a UN recommendation last year in June 2009, in one of its monitoring reports, the UN said that Canada should develop a poverty eradication plan, and the government of Canada responded that it was not its job to develop a plan, that that was the purview of the provinces and territories.
I see. Okay.
So we felt it was exceptionally important to make it clear that we see it as the responsibility of both levels of government.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And of course, cities and school boards, et cetera, also, but certainly the federal, provincial, territorial governments take the lead.
Well, given our trickle-down method of financing, it would strike me that it's substantially the federal government's responsibility, whether administered by the provinces or the cities.
Well, that's certainly one perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you feel was achieved at the Premier's conference in regard to poverty? You urged them to consider it. How did they receive the urging, and what did they do that might reflect their reception of it?
Well, I think at the beginning, shall we say, in our discussions leading up to this meeting, we had hoped that we might have a representative from the Council of the Federation.
Right.
And indeed, we were pleased that Manitoba sent 2 senior civil servants to observe.
Oh, good.
That was fine. But there was no, you know, we did not have formal communication. We did have important informal communication.
Really?
With Premier Selinger and many of the other premiers at a social event that we were invited to.
Okay.
And that's the first time that's ever happened.
Oh.
As well, at the end, you know, the council issues a communique, they call it. It's about a 2.5-page statement. And for the first time, they did mention, commit to reducing poverty, so I can read it to you if you want.
It was in very general terms, I take it.
Yes, it was very general terms. So while we had asked them to establish a working group and report back by next year and to be in touch with federal officials as part of that plan. Oh, you haven't seen the Winnipeg Statement. I will send it to you.
Yeah, please.
Are you on the listserv?
Yeah, I am.
And you didn't get it last week.
Well, that doesn't mean I didn't get it.
Get it if you want, but I basically told you what they did. We basically said we want you to set up a working group.
Yeah.
And report back by your next meeting, which is next summer.
Right.
And by February, we want you to be in touch with federal officials.
Right.
To determine how you might work together on a plan for Canada.
So presumably your timetable allows for a consensus prior to the next meeting of the premiers between the feds and the provinces.
Well, theoretically, and I should say that our partners would very much like there to be a role for civil society, but I think we recognize that while these were reasonable recommendations and expectations, this, to our knowledge, the issue of poverty was not on the formal agenda of the premiers' meeting this time. They certainly talked about education, skills training, labor market development, and those things all are related to reducing poverty. But we do not think they were talking about poverty per se.
Yeah, okay. Who are the people who are the poorest, or at least the most systemically disadvantaged, if not the poorest, and deserving of a more thorough program addressing poverty?
Well, I think we think everybody's deserving. Across the life cycle, there are, income security should be a basic right of Canadians. We've made a good start with regard to children and with regard to seniors, but we need to do a whole lot more, certainly for people with disabilities and for anyone who finds themselves low income for a short or a longer time.
Yeah. It always strikes me that single mothers are among the most disadvantaged monetarily, and they sometimes don't get a fair shake because any subsidies or assistance that they do get is seen as above and beyond, given the low level of fixed income help that they generally do get. I don't know if this is Canada-wide. That's my observation in Ontario. I actually did an interview, had one interviewee comment that single mothers are disadvantaged in fixed incomes because they're having sex, and the proof of it is they have children, and people are envious of this. I don't know if that officially plays into the program, but it was an interesting observation and might account for the low rate of fixed incomes that seems attendant on single motherhood.
Well, I think you have to be a little more specific around. First of all, we don't use the term single. We've been asked by mothers living on their own to use the term lone mother because often
lone.
There is a father in the picture.
He oh,
may
I
or
see.
May not be
right.
supporting, but single implies that there never was anyone, and often
there was
or may still be someone in the picture, albeit not in a full partner role. So that's a question of language.
Yeah, lone mother is a lot less pejorative, I can see that. And lone mother also is a more powerful description of the penalties of raising children without adequate supports. I'm going to use that term from now on, too.
Okay.
Let's take a short break now with Enrico Crivarello and James Harmon, drinking cheap champagne.
I've wasted my whole life just trying to nab me a nip. I worry about it till it keeps me up. Drinking cheap champagne from a Dixie cup. Well, they tell me life is just a dead game test. I didn't know what to study and I just guessed my best. I'm worried about it till it keeps me up. Drinking cheap champagne, love from a Dixie cup. Love from a Dixie cup. Come here, man. It ain't how you do, it's all about who you know. And I'm worried about it till it keeps me up. That's why I'm drinking cheap champagne, love from a Dixie cup. That's what I said. Stomp on in here, talk about it. They always talking about this old lip, sip, flip. I'm worried about it. Y'all, till it keeps me up. I've been drinking cheap champagne live from a dead sicker. Oh, Enrico. We about run out of Dixie cups. Man, let's go down to the store.
You've been listening to Laurel Rothman, Director of Social Reform for Family Services Toronto and the National Director of Campaign 2000, talk about the impact, or not, of the Provincial Premier's Conference on the issues affecting the poor in Canada.
To go back to your question, what was your question?
Single mothers, are they, I don't know how to describe it, are they a group that is unduly impoverished?
Well, I would say, first of all,
I say lone mothers.
Lone mothers, you know, you find lone mothers in all income groups in this country, although,
yes,
unfortunately, there are, you know, far too many children live in lone parent families, and about 85% of lone parent families are headed by mothers.
Right.
So, and what we also know about lone mothers of young children is that, you know, child care and housing are major issues.
Right.
When the OECD studied Canada in 2006, it calculated that only 20% of lone parents and 5% of all disadvantaged groups are receiving, you know, assistance in paying for child care, whether you call it a fee subsidy or whatever you call it. So that's very low.
Right.
So, you know, that's one way. That's not an exact income measure, but it's an essential support for parents.
Yeah. And so, four-fifths of lone parents are without it.
Are not getting that kind of subsidy. So what do they do? Well, some of them means they cannot go back to school or go into work even part-time.
Oh, dear.
Or participate in their communities. Or it means they may be leaving their children in situations which are not regulated, in which they are not reliable and may not last, and in some situations may be unacceptable. It's hard to know. Nobody likes to admit those things, of course, and people do what they have to do to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, appreciated. Where do Aboriginals fall on your scale? I gather this is the focus of the United Nations on poverty in Canada.
Well, that's one of them, certainly. I think what we do know is that in 2005, the first ministers, all the premiers and the prime minister agreed, had a historic agreement committed to improving the quality of life for all Aboriginal people, and unfortunately that was broken or tossed away by the then incoming Prime Minister Harper. So while we have about 1 in 10 children and their families living in poverty, which is about over 600,000 people, about the size of the population of Winnipeg, the situation in First Nations communities is far worse, where about 1 in every 4 children is growing up in poverty.
Right.
Now, many First Nations children or Aboriginal children live in cities, and their situation is also worse than the general average, but children in First Nations reserves are probably among the most both vulnerable economically and remote. So they're in small communities that must rely on themselves and their own resources.
Right. Which is a medical disadvantage, anything that's affected by transportation is disadvantaged, such as bringing in food, bringing in fuel.
Right.
Yeah, bringing in materials for building, for that matter.
Yeah.
Okay. You also mentioned people with disabilities. How do you feel they're disadvantaged? A large percentage of them probably also have migrated to cities for the services there and the reduced penalty for lack of mobility in the city.
Yes, I would say that, you know, the trade-off is that housing is often more expensive in the city, and that can be hard to balance it all off. I'm going to go to my computer and pull up the Winnipeg statement, because we were very pleased to have to hold a roundtable in conjunction with the Council of Canadians with Disabilities. Well, we call them contentions. We were suggested perhaps we should call them messages or
Yeah, contentions does evoke a defensive response, justly or unjustly.
Okay, contention five. Federal and provincial governments must find ways of working together to develop a joint strategy for addressing the disproportionate poverty experienced by Canadians with disabilities. And then we have a couple of paragraphs under there.
What's the measure of the disproportion of that poverty?
Well, I think what we're saying is, we go on to say, poverty, exclusion, and isolation are a shared reality for too many of the 14.3% of Canadians who have a disability.
All right.
While progress has been made over the past 25 years, too many Canadians with disabilities continue to live with the chronic hardships of poverty and face daily barriers to their full participation in Canadian society. Mm-hmm. The personal, social, and economic costs of deprivation and exclusion are too high to be ignored. Now we have a couple of other paragraphs, but that's the gist of it.
You don't know, do you, if that 14.3% applies to lone parents or and Aboriginals as well?
Well, that would probably include everybody. That's a general figure of all over Canadians.
You don't know if it would be higher in those two groups?
I'm guessing it probably would, but I don't know that.
Okay.
I can refer you to them if you want to the council, if you want to talk to them.
Yeah, I think that might be a good idea, although it's not someplace we can go right now. If you have a contact for them,
right.
I'll take it after the interview.
Okay.
So what did the premiers do in addressing these three and other groups, such as the I hate to use a euphemism, but the recently unemployed in this economic crash that we've experienced?
Well, as I said, we weren't party to their specific discussions.
And they have no paper or something?
Well, yes. The communique that came out last Friday, which I will send you, that's where I read and I said that it's the first time they mentioned. They said they would continue to promote a number of things, including reducing poverty.
All right.
So that's as far as we... That's as much as we have. So we consider that a mini achievement to get it on the radar screen and have them, as we would say, articulate the P word, say
right.
poverty. But
right.
There's a lot more to come.
Does anybody outside Campaign 2000 and the groups represented on it talk about eradicating poverty?
Yes, actually, we talked about eradicating poverty.
Right.
The premiers used the word reducing poverty.
Okay.
We did talk about eradication, and I will say to you, our second-to-last paragraph, in the statement, which I will send to you, we who are participants at this historic roundtable know that poverty eradication is not a utopian dream, but a credible goal that is achievable over the next decade. In concrete terms, poverty eradication means pursuing the lowest possible levels of poverty in the industrialized world, both in incidence and depth. Lowest levels in today's terms would mean the complete elimination of deep poverty, which is below 40% of median income.
Right.
And general poverty levels, that is, below 50% of median, of no more than 4%.
And what's the median income across the country?
I'd have to check it. I don't have it right at my fingertips.
Ballpark it?
Pardon me?
Can you ballpark it? I would assume it varies widely if you include the territories.
No, actually, Statistics Canada does not even, they don't collect data regularly from the territories.
Okay.
Well, median income...
And tell us how medians arrived at for the listener who might mistake it for an average.
Okay, the median is the point below which 50% of the population is located.
Okay.
And 50% is above it.
Okay. So it's higher than an average.
It can be.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking that an average would of course take the number of people who are earning different incomes and just divide by the number of people, and at that point, the sheer number of people in the low-income brackets would pull the average income down to a lower figure.
But it can work the other way around. that, you know, we have a very skewed population.
A very what?
Skewed distribution of income, so the upper end can also make it look higher.
Yeah. I guess what would determine that is the strength of the middle class, wouldn't it, really? Would determine whether median is above or below average. And there seems to be no doubt in my mind, and although I don't have stats, that the strength of the middle class has been challenged for some decades now.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm not finding it where I thought I could find it.
Oh, that's not important. From the Premier's report, we have a very broad general consensus to reduce poverty. Nothing more than that.
Well, I don't think I would call it a consensus. I have to be fair here and say...
Alberta came out against it.
No, not necessarily. It's so general. Premiers will also continue... I'm reading word for word from the communique, which I can send you.
All right.
Will continue, or send you the link, to promote sustained economic recovery by fostering a culture of innovation, encouraging continued private sector investments, removing barriers to economic development, expanding trade, strengthening Canada's labor market, and reducing poverty.
Okay.
So it's one of a number of things.
Yeah.
Readers will take from that what they wish, and we will take it at face value and push for implementation, definition and implementation.
Yeah. Well, it seems implicit in that declaration is the recognition that if people don't have money to spend, they're not going to contribute to a recovery.
Well,
which
that's,
is very basic recognition, but you've come a long way to have that recognized.
Actually, we do think that. Actually do think that.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to add to what we've discussed?
Well, I think what I'd like to say to all your listeners is keep working on it. You know, we're probably... keep raising the issue as you meet with elected officials at all levels in Ontario. We're having municipal elections this year.
Yes.
We expect we will have a federal election by next spring and certainly a provincial election in October 2011. I think the message is, you know, poverty eradication is good for us all.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, we all pay one way, shape, form, or another. So improving the lives of low-income people will have a benefit for all of us.
On that note, I'd like to leave people to think about that. Thanks very much, Laurel. Stay with me.
You've been listening to Laurel Rothman, Director of Social Reform for Family Services Toronto and the National Director of Campaign 2000, talk about the impact, or not, of the Provincial Premier's Conference on the issues affecting the poor in Canada. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories from the newspapers that we read to you, but these are excerpts or abbreviations, condensations of the stories from the newspapers that we name on the show. From the National Post, outside police investigate officer who shoved woman with MS to the ground. Vancouver, an outside police force has been called in to investigate after a Vancouver officer shoved a woman with multiple sclerosis to the ground in the city's downtown east side. The Vancouver Police Department said that officers from the nearby New Westminster Police Service will investigate the attack, which was caught on video and went viral last week. The department confirmed the officer is no longer walking a beat in the troubled neighborhood. The video shows three male Vancouver police officers walking side by side along a crowded street. A woman appears to come into the path of the officers and lightly brushes one. One of the officers is shown giving her a hard shove to the ground. All three officers then walk away while she remains on the ground before another civilian helps her to her feet, and she staggers away. Toronto Star, Sarah Boysfeld. Acting on a community complaint, police raided a downtown club where ill patients go to buy medical marijuana, the second raid on the operation in less than 6 months. They seized a quantity of marijuana and hashish, said Detective Jim Bronze, who was among the 12 officers who entered the CALM Compassion Club, which operates behind a storefront at 106 Queen Street East. They also arrested club owner Neve Tapiero at his apartment around the corner from CALM, which stands for Cannabis's Living
Spring Medicine, said his lawyer, Ron Marzell, who specializes in battling the country's marijuana laws. Another man who was in the apartment, Mr. Tapiro, was arrested, too. Pending charges include possession of marijuana and hashish for the purpose of trafficking, Detective Braun said. According to Mr. Marzell, the complaints are coming from a neighbor who is trying to lease a property near Calm and has complained about a smell of marijuana coming from the club. Detective Bronze led a fleet of officers who raided the Compassion Club at the end of March. That raid was also based on a community complaint, he said. Calm was out of commission for 2 weeks after the March raid. Toronto Star, Saturday, August 7th. Lawsuit seeks $45 million in damages. James Poisson, staff reporter. Office Administrator Sherry Good is now the face of a G20 class action lawsuit launched against the Toronto Police Services Board and the Attorney General of Canada, who represents the RCMP. Filed Thursday, that was August 5th, in Ontario Supreme Court, the lawsuit seeks $45 million in damages for all those wrongfully arrested, detained, imprisoned, or held by police during the G20 summit at locations across the city. According to Good's lawyers, Murray Klippenstein and Eric Gillespie, the Ontario Provincial Police may be named at a later date. Good was approached by Klippenstein after posting her story on the website asking for G20 accounts. On the evening of June 27, Good was caught by a police technique known as kettling when about 250 people, some protesters, other bystanders, were encircled by a wall of police officers at the intersection of Queen Street West and Spadina Avenue. She was walking home when she decided to join an informal demonstration. Good said she was held in a downpour for hours with no food or access to toilets and was terrified by police. She was later released but said she was so shaken up she couldn't sleep that night, didn't attend work the next day, and had a panic attack as a result. The biggest consequence was that I lost all trust in police, she said. Now I'm nervous when I see a police car. I consistently look over my shoulder. For Good, it is a privilege to represent all those detained without charge, even though she feels the lawsuit could be a difficult journey. The next step involves the court's approval of the class action lawsuit, a process Gillespie admitted could take longer than a year. Those who wish to be involved in the lawsuit can contact the legal team or go through the website www.g20classaction.com. Precedents include a similar lawsuit launched after mass arrests in Washington, D.C. in 2000 near the World Bank and International Monetary Fund buildings. The district was ordered to pay $13.7 million in damages to some 700 demonstrators and bystanders last month. If the G20 class action lawsuit gets that far, it would be up to courts to divvy up any monetary award. And from the Toronto Sun, exclusive, Antonella Artuso, Queen's Park Bureau Chief. Drug price shock. Government reforms cause costs of some meds to skyrocket. The prices of dozens of generic drugs have gone up, with one medication increasing in cost by almost 1,000%. Following government-ordered drug reforms that are supposed to save money on prescriptions, some pharmacists say. One well-known generic drug company's new pricing list obtained by the Toronto Sun shows that about 300 of its products are coming down in price, but more than 100 drugs will cost patients more. The list applies to so-called private payers, people who purchase their prescriptions out of pocket or through a private insurance company. Alan Rothman, owner of a medicine shop pharmacy in Toronto, said customers who understand from Health Minister Deb Matthews that generic drug prices would fall are shocked to find it's not true for all medications. In response to concerns that Ontarians were paying too much for generic drugs compared to other jurisdictions, the Dalton-McGuinty government ushered in reforms earlier this year that required drug companies to lower their costs. Private payers are to get drugs at half the original cost. Ivan Langrish, a spokesman for Matthews, said the government price restraints apply only to generic drugs that are listed on the Ontario Drug Benefit Formulary. Some drugs, such as those that come in spray or cream form, may be exempted from the price controls because they cost more to manufacture. As well, the price of Ontario Drug Benefit listed generic drugs for private payers will gradually decrease to match that of the Ontario Drug Benefit by 2012, he said. The pharmacists argue that the reforms aren't really saving money. Rothman said prices have been lowered so much for the Ontario Drug Benefit that costs need to be recouped from private players. Toronto Star, Tanya Talaga, Queen's Park Bureau. McGuinty urges partnership for approving drugs. Proposal comes as premiers remain divided over clinical trials for controversial multiple sclerosis treatment. Premier Dalton McGuinty urged the provinces to coordinate purchase and approval of prescription drugs as Canada's premiers remain divided over funding for clinical trials of a controversial multiple sclerosis treatment. Drug approval agencies in each of our territories, McGuinty said, are luxuries we can no longer afford. The joint purchasing power of the provinces and territories would be worth $10 billion, McGuinty added. His remarks came as several provinces signaled support of Saskatchewan's move to fund clinical trials for an experimental multiple sclerosis treatment. Ontario has been reluctant to follow suit. But the Yukon is interested in joining with Saskatchewan if and when they pursue trials of the so-called liberation therapy, Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall said. British Columbia is also closely watching developments. We welcome all partnerships, Wall said. Liberation treatment is an Italian therapy that opens up narrowed veins so blood can flow easily from the heart to the brain. Saskatchewan has one of the highest incidence rates of MS in Canada. Each province is trying to do things differently to try to save health dollars, said Wall. He added he is not concerned MS patients will migrate to Saskatchewan for their medical needs. If you live on the west side of the province, as I do, sometimes you access health care in a neighboring province, he said. I'm not sure we want to move to a point where we're limiting that. One of the strengths of Confederation is that we can bring different strengths to the table in terms of health care, and I'm not sure that is a bad thing. What do you think, Dalton? Globe and Mail, Wednesday, August 4th, by Carly Weeks. Canadian Medical Association urges dramatic overhaul of health system. The country's healthcare system is failing too many Canadians and needs a dramatic overhaul, including universal prescription drug coverage, a new Canadian Medical Association report urges. Quote, the present system will not be able to meet future needs, unquote, CMA President Ann Deutsch told reporters Tuesday. We need healthcare transformation and we need it now. Some of the most significant changes the association is calling for include the prescription drug proposal, a charter that enshrines the rights of patients, an independent body that can monitor whether health dollars are being spent efficiently, and monetary incentives for doctors and hospitals to treat more patients. The main premise behind the proposed changes is that healthcare in Canada must be focused squarely on patients. One of the boldest proposals is for Canada to adopt prescription drug coverage. Most parts of Canada do have catastrophic drug coverage programs, which are aimed at people facing extraordinary costs for drugs to treat serious illness or disease, but the CMA argues that coverage should be comprehensive, paying for less expensive medications that could still present a financial burden to patients. It's an important idea that could result in significant cost savings in the long term, experts say. Health Minister Leona Aglukkaq is aware that some provinces are experimenting with incentive models similar to those discussed in the report, and that those experiences will help determine if those programs play a bigger role in the future. The report also says Canada should cover drugs to treat rare diseases, which are often expensive. The CMA also calls for the creation of a patient charter that pledges to treat patients with dignity and respect, and ensure timely access to medical services. Bob Hepburn in The Star. Healthcare in Ontario is cracking under stress. McGuinty's proposed shift to home care is failing due to lack of adequate funding. Health Minister Deb Matthews staged a news conference to boast about how some hospitals are reducing wait times and to pledge extra money to hire more staff and buy more high-tech equipment for emergency rooms. But both McGuinty and Matthews are strangely silent these days about community and home care, one of the most critical parts of the healthcare system that's becoming a province-wide nightmare, Indeed, because of government neglect, the entire healthcare system is unraveling at the seams. Since coming to power in 2003, McGuinty's promoted a shift in the delivery of healthcare away from hospitals and institutions and toward providing more care in the community and at home. It's a laudable move. However, the government has failed to adequately fund such programs, resulting in tens of thousands of patients receiving fewer and fewer visits from trained professionals in their community or homes, or going without services at all. And the problem is expected to grow worse, not better. Community care access centers, the government agencies charged with coordinating health services in the province, have been forced to refer only the most needy cases for help. Evidence of the cuts is clear. Home visits by occupational therapists dropped 24% in the 2008-2009 fiscal year over the same period a year earlier. Visits by physiotherapists were down 9%. Visits by dietitians were off 2%. Visits by speech-language pathologists plunged a whopping 40% from 461,484 in the 2007-08 fiscal year to 274,068 visits in the last year. A Toronto agency that provides therapists for outpatients received 40% fewer referrals for adult physiotherapy this June than in June 2009. Consider that in recent months, major institutions such as Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital and Credit Valley Hospital in Mississauga have either laid off rehab professionals or slashed their rehab programs, forcing more and more patients to seek services in the community. The Canadian Medical Association released a report calling for sweeping changes in the healthcare system, including increased investment in community and home care. It noted that hospitals are now focusing mainly on patients who are acutely ill, closing their clinics that provided such services as rehab, physio, and occupational therapy. Because of the sudden drop in patient referrals from community care access centers, or CCACs, many of the private firms that link patients and CCACs with health professionals are struggling to survive. The next step would be to listen to people on the front lines, those who actually provide service to patients on a daily basis. In that vein, Matthews is to meet with Susan Vanderbent, Executive Director of the Ontario Home Care Association, an organization of home health and social care service providers, and senior members of her association. She would do well to listen very closely because the health of everyone who needs help in Ontario is at stake. Toronto Star. Budget chief agrees with funeral homes. David Ryder, Urban Affairs Bureau Chief. The City of Toronto's budget chief agrees with local funeral homes that they are being dramatically underpaid for so-called pauper's funerals. In this day and age, I think most people know that $2,200 is not nearly enough to cover a full funeral, that the market rates are higher, Councillor and Budget Chief Shelley Carroll said in an interview. The Star revealed Wednesday that the association representing Toronto Funeral Homes is preparing to lobby councillors for an increase in the $2,208.88 subsidy they get for providing full rights for social assistance and provincial disability recipients. The businesses say the gap between the subsidy and the real cost of about $5,500 costs them cumulatively millions of dollars a year, and either the subsidy needs to rise or the services must be stripped down. The city spends $4 million per year on funerals and burials for the poor, but recovers 80% of the costs from the Ontario government. And in the Globe and Mail, August 6, 2010, an essay by Margaret Hollingsworth. Bullied for the way I spoke. My parents understood what I said, but children didn't even try. Instead, they ridiculed me and left me out. I was born with a cleft palate. Fortunately, my lip was not cleft, but for all the doctor's deafness, I was left with throat complications and residual deafness that kept me in hospital for months. I talked eagerly early in life, unintelligibly. My parents understood me, but neighborhood children and kids at school didn't even try. I was often ridiculed, rarely befriended. I was often shielded by solicitous teachers, but when I was 8, I went to a new school and the bullying began in earnest. The girls made fun of me behind their hands. The fact that I couldn't always hear them made me anticipate the giggles and name-calling by sticking out my tongue. The boys were more open with their taunts. They'd shout in my ear, imitating me. Sometimes they'd pair up, cross their arms behind their backs, and run at me. Names did hurt. I didn't want my parents to be shamed on my behalf, and I definitely didn't want them fighting my battles, so I never tattled on my schoolyard foes. At 16, I had a new beginning. I became a filing clerk at a multinational in the heart of London. I was one of the most inept filers on record, but at the end of each week I had money to put toward a new round of what was now called speech therapy. This time I understood its importance and I threw myself into it, practicing vowel sounds and hissing and trying to redirect my breath so it didn't leak down my nose. I invested in an unobtrusive hearing aid. I triumphed over my L's and my N's, though they still trip me up, and lessened the nasal quality of my voice. I immigrated to Canada in 1968, and here, to my delight, most people spoke nasally, and no one appeared to notice the vestiges of my speech defect. My adrenaline still flows whenever I perceive that I'm on the receiving end of a put-down or a raw deal, and this has held me back, particularly in my work with theater. In Ontario, the number of speech-language pathologists has been cut, and wait lists are growing. In times of restraint, priorities must be set, and speech-language pathology doesn't appear to be one of them. The understanding of what's needed to help adults and kids communicate clearly and effectively is now much more advanced, but the understanding of why it's so vital may need updating. No one has to suffer the kind of ridicule and humiliation I endured. No one has to live with its consequences. I hope someone is listening. Karen Howlett and Patrick White in the Toronto Star. Premier's address sustainability of elephant in the room, healthcare. For the first time as a group, the premiers tackled the question of whether the country can afford to sustain a system many Canadians appear to take for granted, and sparked the early stages of a potentially divisive debate over a federal funding accord set to expire in 2014. It's the elephant in the room for all of us, Premier Jean Charest told reporters at the annual meeting of provincial leaders in Winnipeg. Mr. Charest said everyone, including politicians, acknowledges privately that the health care system is unsustainable. But publicly, he said, everyone walks on eggs because they don't want to offend anyone. Currently, health care costs are rising between 5 and 7% every year. Left unrestrained, they're set to reach between 70 and 80% of total provincial spending by 2030, according to a recent study at the Toronto Dominion Bank. It's the most important program we deliver in Canada, said Prince Edward Island Premier Robert Guise. It really defines us as a country. About 20 cents of every dollar the province has spent on health care comes from Ottawa. They are slated to receive annual increases of 6% until the fiscal year that starts on April 1, 2013, under the Canada Health Transfer Program. The premiers are urging Ottawa to strike a new accord under the same terms. If health spending is not tied to the actual increase in costs, said Nova Scotia Premier Darrell Dexter, then you are essentially withdrawing from health care funding. Mr. Guise warned that if federal funding does not keep pace with rising costs, the quality of health care would suffer. If the federal government reduces its payments, the provinces, many of which are deep in deficit, will be hard-pressed to pick up the slack. At a June meeting in Prince Edward Island, provincial finance ministers asked officials to start preparing for a renewal of federal transfers in 2014, but this is the first time the premier so publicly stressed its importance. Cancer care lagging. Again, the Globe and Mail. The Canadian healthcare system is slow to provide patients with the latest advances in cancer drugs, suggests a recent study that looked at the international use of prescription medications. The study, commissioned by the British Secretary of State for Health, compared 14 countries for the usage of 14 categories of prescription drugs to determine whether the British government is adequately meeting the health needs of its citizens. Among the details in the report, Canada was ranked 13th out of 14 in terms of the use of new cancer drugs launched within the past 5 years. At the other end of the spectrum, France, Austria, and the United States took the top rankings. For For many in Canada, that reality means trying to pay for a treatment that's unaffordable, which creates an impossible choice. Your health or financial solvency for your family, Dr. Kong Koo, Vice Chair of the Cancer Advocacy Coalition of Canada, said in a prepared statement. Monitor named at problem-plagued Windsor Hospital, Globe and Mail, Karen Howlett and Carolyn Alfonso. A Windsor, Ontario hospital at the center of a scandal over diagnostic test errors as a culture characterized by distrust and disrespect, says a report that highlights the need for quality pathology services across the province. Ontario Health Minister Deb Matthews responded immediately by appointing a facilitator at Hotel Dieu Grace Hospital to oversee changes. The report released on Wednesday concludes that the hospital's problems are much deeper than pathology errors made by a now-suspended pathologist. It says the hospital's atmosphere is characterized by an alarming lack of respect between medical leaders, senior management, and the board of directors. Prior to the incidents in Windsor, health labs in Newfoundland and Quebec recently botched breast cancer tests, failing hundreds of patients. The probe in Windsor was initiated after it came to light this year that a surgeon at Hotel Dieu had performed mastectomies on two cancer-free women and that the pathologist at the center of it, Olive Williams, allegedly made mistakes on tests. A three-person team of investigators led by Barry McClellan, Chief Executive Officer of Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, found an atmosphere at Hotel Dieu characterized by distrust and disrespect between medical staff and management that has existed for more than a decade. McClellan's team reviewed 6,227 cases of Dr. Williams, who came on staff in 2003. The hospital suspended her in January after launching its own review of her work. It blamed a series of diagnostic errors in part on cataracts that blurred her vision. They highlighted 45 of her cases that need further probing and said the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario should assess her competency if she wants to resume practicing medicine in the province. The report was largely positive for Hotel Dieu surgeon Barbara Hartwell, who performed mastectomies on two women who did not have breast cancer, saying she generally performed safe surgery and provided safe care. Both Drs. Hartwell and Williams are under investigation by the College of Physicians and Surgeons. Hotel Dieu's issues run so deep that its chief of surgery, Alan Force, is resigning as of August 31st, with sources saying his decision to leave after 12 years reflects his frustration that the hospital's problems go beyond pathology. Warren Chant, the chief executive officer of Hotel Dieu, declined to comment Wednesday on Dr. Force's departure.
And that's all for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. There will be more. Going out, Snooky Pryor and Slow Down.
Yes, I love you, baby, but I can't stand your evil ways. together religion. Devil won't even let me pray. Yes, I'm trying to get a religion. Devil won't even let me pray. Every time I fall on my knees, show me a brand new way. Yes, I try to live on it. Won't believe a word I say. Well, you think I'm a fool, but I'll let you have your way. All right, little girl. You gotta work, you gotta work.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.